And so Sam would make an art asset and then break it into pieces and export it as individual pieces. Then Seth would go animate it somehow. And that was a
somehow thing. Indeed.
Scotch.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 264 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast, Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam and I'm drinking terrible coffee.
I'm Sam and I'm the artist.
And this is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is June 21, 2020, blendy. Before we get started, we have a warning, swears, we're going to do them on this show. So just know that that's coming. We'd also like to thank our recurring supporters over at moneygrab.bscotch.net. If you'd like to support this podcast, get over to moneygrab.bscotch.net and we'll just go ahead and grab your money. Let's talk about life.
What happened?
Standing desks.
Mm.
Standing desks. Let's talk about them. I got one. Sam, you got one. You've had one for quite some time.
I have. I've had mine for probably 6 months now. I've decided, so it was about last October, I think, or November, after I had done something like another 100 plus hours of art practice at home, bent over a surface like a strange, you know, witch,
like a caveman
scrawling on a tablet,
like a golem, like a technical caveman.
Mm-hmm. That I decided,
technical caveman.
I hate this, and I shouldn't have to do this. So what am I doing? And so, I basically got a desktop machine, which I hadn't had like a fancy desktop that actually has power. For about 4 years or so, because. You know, it's one of those things, like at some point you're just like, well, I want to stay mobile, stay light. And so I kind of switched to a laptop for a couple of years and then we had the studio, blah, blah, blah. So I ended up getting my home office set up and then found myself still, you know, kind of hunched over stuff all the time. And sitting down always was just kind of annoying. And so I did some research and then ended up finding a desk. So I used this one called an Uplift desk, which has little programmable keys. So you program the position, you hit the button, and it's like, and then it puts it where it needs to go, right? And it's like having an R2-D2 assistance situation.
Yeah, it is.
And everybody can hear it screaming too when I turn on and there's a voice chat happening, which is very fun. So I switched to it because, you know, I just realized I was like, if this is my job and one of the tools for my job is actually my body position and also my body, right? So I need to make sure that I can have those both be good enough that I'm not in a serious amount of pain or putting myself into trouble in like 5 years. It's a DevOps problem, right? I'm like, solve this problem here.
It is.
Not later. And so, yeah, I switched over and it's been good. I honestly probably stand for like not that much every day, but even 30 minutes to like 2 hours is fucking amazing compared to constantly sitting. And so,
yeah, I think that's the key.
Yeah. So Seth, you got yours. Yours came in what, on Friday?
Mine came in on Friday. I also got the Uplift desk just because I did want the ability to move it up and down without just being stuck standing or stuck sitting. Cause I don't want to be right back in the same problem, but different. I don't want to be standing for 12 hours a day. Because that also sounds terrible.
Yeah, it actually is very bad for you. Yeah, it's basically the point is it's very bad to do either one of these things all the time.
Don't do something for 12 hours a day. Just don't.
Well, really the good part is moving. Yeah, so correct. It's actually moving between sitting and standing that's the part that's good for you.
So really you need a squat desk that just constantly is moving up and down. And you just do it squats.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you're just doing very slow squats all day.
That'd be extremely painful.
Yeah, so I got the thing. First of all, this thing is a tank.
Yeah.
I mean, it is heavy. I didn't realize this desk probably weighs 200 pounds.
It's a hefty one.
I was thinking about getting a monster.
But does that mean I have to carry 200 pounds up three flights of stairs?
Yes. No, because, well, it comes in like four boxes of parts.
How much does each box weigh?
You know, they're
fine. Actually, the problem is the top of the desk, because it's like a solid piece of wood. And people forget just how fucking heavy
wood is.
It's heavy and big, right? Yeah. So this new desk is 60 inches, so I guess 5 feet, right? 60 inches by 30 inches. My old desk was 24 by 48. So already I'm like, boom, huge real estate. The legs of this desk are like industrial hydraulic monsters. each leg is super heavy. And I was thinking about the logistics of this because it has two individual legs and they have to be perfectly calibrated. Because if one of them is like a quarter of an inch higher, then your whole desk is sloped, right? Mm-hmm. So the engineering on this thing, super fucking cool. I got it all put together. It took like an hour and a half to put the thing together, and then another half hour to like get all my shit cleared off my old desk, you know, make the move. It's kind of like when people need to change their purse out for the night and they got to dump all the shit out and like figure out what to take, you know, it's the same kind of thing. But, so I got it set up. I programmed my three states: sitting, standing, and standing with shoes. Cause you know, your shoes give you like an extra, you know, half an inch or quarter inch of height, and you don't want to fuck up your ergonomics just cause you put boots on. So I stood for like an hour on Friday, and my feet fucking hurt because I was like, I just haven't stood.
That's crazy. Yeah. That's
crazy. Like the most I've had to stand is just kind of like maybe I'll go for a short walk with my dog, or I'll walk from one place to another in the house. But everything that happens in the house is just is sitting or lying down, right? Maybe I'll cook something for 20 minutes or something. That's it. So my feet were killing me. And I was like, okay, clearly I need to get back in to using my body for things. So Saturday I did some work on the computer and stuff, and I was just determined to stand as much as possible to kind of like get past the hump. I woke up this morning, my ass hurt. from literally just standing. You don't realize just how out of shape you get from just sitting.
Well, I mean, honestly, it's important. Hours. Like, if you know, when you're, like, if you ever get stuck in a hospital and you just have to, and you're stuck in a bed for a couple weeks or something like that, even a couple days, like, your body just starts melting, like, just straight up. Like, just the whole thing. It just
gives up.
It's like, I don't need these muscles anymore. Don't worry about it.
It's that muscles are very costly to maintain. So yes. Your body's like, I don't need these. Let me just recycle. Right. So it starts,
body's just being efficient.
It's just being efficient. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's been really nice. And I'm looking forward to actually being able to work, but I was having a conversation with, Sampada, because she's been running, and she made an interesting comment about how she would run on treadmills back when we were able to, you know, go to gyms. Mm-hmm. She would run on treadmills and always had just a hell of a time breaking past this certain pace. To like run in a mile. And now she's running outdoors. So not on a treadmill and running in it. We have like a really bad hilly area, like right near our place. Yeah, it's like a big loop.
It's a rough run.
It's a steep ass hill. And she is running that loop, which is also a mile. She's running that loop like a minute and a half faster than she was able to do on a treadmill. And we were kind of talking about how weird that is, but I think it's because when you're on a treadmill, you just pick one, right? And depending on what your body needs, because like as you run over the course of a mile, you're going to speed up, you're going to slow down, you know, you're going to be changing your pace depending on how it feels and depending on your stride.
You're on a hill, all that stuff.
Yeah. Treadmill doesn't give a fuck. Treadmill is just like, this is how you're running, which means you're going to be at the wrong pace just a lot of the time, and you're going to just have a harder time getting there. You're going to feel worse. You're going to go slower, right? Because you're not able to respond to what your body needs to do. I was thinking about this standing desk thing, you know, where like we were in our level head postmortem on Friday, which was basically a 6-hour meeting, right? We were just like breaking down all the things that went we're going on level head. We'll talk about it a little bit later, but point is, sitting there chatting for 6 hours, and at various points, because like I didn't have my standing desk at that point, so at various points I was like laying on the floor, I was standing and like trying to aim my webcam up, because as you're just chatting with people for that long, you know, you got to move around.
Yeah,
you can't just sit in a chair stationary talking to people for 6 hours. It's crazy.
Building some of that work and some of that variability. And I think especially now with so many people who are working remote, we used to, when we work in the office, you would physically have to get up to go talk to someone. right? Or to go check out someone's machine.
Or we'd go to a conference room and we would be just standing in there.
Yep. Or go down to the break room, right? Every hour or two to go grab like a new cup of coffee or whatever else. And so that included, the flight of stairs and then probably standing around talking to someone for a couple extra minutes.
Yeah, there was just a lot of just natural movement.
Yeah.
You know?
And so that definitely is something to keep in mind if you're one of the people who is now working from home, or even if you're not necessarily working, but you're working from home, but just something to keep in mind is that moving your body is absolutely crucial to keeping it actually functioning for as long as possible. So
definitely. Yeah, it's one of those perks, we talk about. If you're working from home, you no longer have a commute, right? Which is great, but also having that, whatever it is, 15, 20 minutes of sort of like a hard break between your home life and your work life, it sometimes allows you to get more done at work because you're definitely like in more of a work mode. And it also gives you time to like listen to a podcast or something on the way to work, or just like think about things for a while. And a lot of the structures that get created by a physical working space are actually kind of conducive to just like being a person, walking around or standing in a conference room to chat about things, and you just don't realize
one kind of thing.
Yep, yeah. Just period.
Just period.
And you just don't realize how many of those things you lose when you switch to a work from home until months down the line when you stand for 1 hour and your ass hurts. it's something to think about. And I was thinking about the cost, because like the desk was pricey. I mean,
yeah, there are cheaper ones out there for sure. But far as like the types.
Yeah, I think it was probably like $800 or something. But I was thinking about this in the context of sort of like dollars per hour, right? Mm-hmm. So if I'm at this desk for like 70 hours a week, which I definitely am, then over the course of a year, of the first year of having this desk, I will have spent like 20 cents per hour of using this desk.
It's just like the bed. It's like Adam's bed jet that we were talking about, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Find those things that you actually are using all the time and make just sure all you're the time. Doing them very well, right?
Yeah. Most hours of the day you're using this thing, and it's easy to look at the cash outlay and just be like, oh, no thanks, right? But when you start to actually think about the benefits that you get and just how much time you're going to be using this thing, it really adds up. So anyways, I thought kind of it's been really nice to have. And I think that realization of like the treadmill versus running thing was kind of an interesting analogy. So let's talk about, before we talk about studio stuff, let's talk a little bit about Avatar, the show.
Yeah, which has been blown up on Netflix. I'm sure everyone's seen it. It's been talked about for a couple of weeks now, I feel like, since it came out, basically. Yeah.
This show's been out since early 2000s, right? Like, it's been around. And the people who did see it back then have always known that it's a great show, right? Mm-hmm. And it came to Netflix, and now all of a sudden it's just there, and all these millions of people who are subscribing to Netflix just get to check it out without having to do anything extra, right? And I'm one of those people. I had never seen it. We didn't have I think it was on Nickelodeon, right?
Yeah.
So like we didn't have cable and stuff growing up, so we didn't even know that this show existed back then.
Yeah, definitely. I saw it senior year at one of my friends' house.
Yeah. And so I checked it out. I ended up watching the entire thing, also all three seasons in like a week. It is so fucking good. I get it. Like I get why people are pumped about it. Sam, you said you just started it.
Yeah, I just started with my wife on Saturday, and it's fascinating because I think, when the characters are very fun and strong and they're interesting. Their relationships are always one of the focuses of any given episode, any two people or sort of what they're working through. But then beyond that, the comedic timing and the visual gags are just like – they are just
top notch.
Just real good. And like my wife and I watched Guardians of the Galaxy a few weeks ago and watched the second one, but like it wasn't quite as good as the first, and we couldn't quite figure out why. It was definitely the jokes, but it wasn't 100% clear exactly why they didn't quite work. But then when it came to watching Avatar, it's like, oh, here's like, here that is again. Like that sort of just funness, even when it's enmeshed in like really horrifying things, or like you're running away from someone who's literally trying to burn you to death in the case of Avatar. And then like, and they literally somehow crack like a visual gag as that's happening, right? Or like or an actual joke. And so it's just really fun. It's just a very fun show to watch.
Yeah, they do such a good job of contrast between
these
sort of competing, really dark and intense kinds of moments that are interspersed, and they do it right. So it's not, they don't like make light of a thing that's actually just dark.
Correct.
But they surround the dark thing with light things, right? So that it all still kind of works. And so, yeah, it's just a remarkable job of storytelling, and also the amount of effort they put into normalizing stuff like in the real world that they want to be normalized, right? Is also really interesting because how like how women characters work in the show and how like disabled characters work in the show. If you actually pay really close attention, you'll notice that you mostly don't notice, which is actually the point, right?
That's the point, yeah.
And when you do notice, it's because they're kind of drawing attention actually to like in the real world, a thing that inequality that exists here, right? That like in the context of the show is actually a surprise when it appears, because that's the thing that should be normal, not the fact that the inequality exists. You know,
right? So
there's like all like talk like every dimension of that show, from the storytelling, the characters, like the messages they're trying to give, because like the characters do are little shits a lot of the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they mistreat each other here and there, right? Because they're kids, right? And they do some fucked up things, and within the span of like a single episode, somebody will make a mistake, and then they'll talk it through, and then they'll recover and then forgive each other, right? And move their relationship forward, right? In this like really amazing way that, you know, if you think about like modern sitcoms and stuff, where the reason that modern sitcoms exist is that all the characters are shits to each other the whole time. That's like, mm-hmm. that's how, and the fact that they don't resolve their conflicts is actually what allows the thing to persist over, you know, 10 different seasons, right? So yeah, I think it's like, it's just so wholesome and then so like also intense, you know.
Yeah, you know, I'm probably going to get a lot of flack for what I'm about to say, but here's the thing: I'm not on Twitter, so nobody has any way of giving me flack.
You can't get hit by the flack cannon.
So, The Office, I watched it. They might, in my opinion, they might as well call this show a bunch of assholes working together because like. Because
– yeah, I loved it the first time, and then the second time through I started to get a little iffy because my wife has rewatched it a few times, and so I re-caught bits and pieces of it, you know. And each subsequent time I saw an episode, I was like, oh, that's kind of
– yeah. You like once you start thinking about – like if you think about these characters as people, you know, you've got like Jim who is constantly bullying Dwight. Just constantly, right? Like Dwight comes into work. All Dwight wants to do is grow his beats and move up the corporate ladder, right? Like he's not hurting anybody. He's just chilling. And all of a sudden his fucking staplers and in his desk embedded in Jell-O. And that's just a thing that he has to deal with now because somebody else thought it would be funny to like interfere with his stuff, right? And yeah, like the characters are constantly trying to get out of doing anything useful or helping each other. They're screwing each other over all the time. I don't know. Just like as I was watching, I was like, I don't like any of these people. Mm-hmm. They're just bad. They're just bad people who are bad to each other.
I think rewatching sitcoms is very enlightening because also one of the other ones that my wife and I watched, I guess seemingly forever ago now, was How I Met Your Mother. And at first, I actually found like all the characters pretty endearing and like kind of funny because they're deeply flawed, but like it's all about the jokes, right? But the more the seasons wore on, the more I started to like look past the immediacy of like the jokes and like this we're all everything seems very positive even when it's, you know, negative and stuff. And I started to be able to kind of see past it and just see just how fucked up.
Mm.
Everything was and like right. and like how misogynistic the show is, like they, like actually on every level you look at it is fucked up. It is horrible, but they somehow managed to hide it behind this set of like of the stuff that behind laugh tracks, right? And the idea of like what's being normalized, right? And they've actually taken all the things that are normal about how shitty real people are to each other all the time, and they turned that into the joke.
Into like a celebration.
Yeah, which is actually also what The Office is, right? They're taking like the real things that people do to be shitty to each other, and then they take it to an absurd level so that it becomes a joke. But what's underneath the surface is like, this is like the real shittiness that people actually have, right?
But how does that compare to like, because Parks and Rec, for example, has a different.
Parks and Rec has
similar but different sort of.
It does, right? Yeah. I mean, there's like, I love
the way they treat Jerry. Drives me fucking crazy.
Yeah. The fact that there's a character who just is bullied by the entire rest of the characters.
The whole time.
The entire time. It just doesn't have to be there. Mm-hmm. You know? Because those characters are actually like, once you cut that out, if you didn't have that, the story would still be the same.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And you would just have a bunch of people who are just actually nice to each other.
Except for Tom, who's kind of, in my opinion, no redeemable qualities the entire time. is just a piece of shit, like all the way through.
Yeah. Adam, I agree with this idea that, you know, these shows were all written in a certain cultural point in time, you know.
This is true for those that are coming out now.
Oh, yeah, it is.
The current time is not also a good time, you know.
Yeah, but I'm talking about actually us as the viewers, right?
Yeah.
And like when these shows are written, they're oftentimes written around the things that people just take for granted, you know, at that point in time. And so do we as the viewers, right? Like, sure, you go into the office and you just bully people. That's like how you do it.
It's a shitty experience and nobody's having a good time. Yeah.
Yeah. And then 10 years later, you know, as you yourself have learned more about the world and how, hey, you know, maybe don't treat people like shit. Maybe just don't do that. Then you go back and rewatch this thing that you used to love and you realize this is horrifying. the kinds of things that this celebrates and normalizes are terrible. And this is where I think kind of looping it back, why I think Avatar deserves a lot of respect for what they've done, because that just isn't present in this show.
Yeah, it's just not there.
And it's a much older show than a lot of these other things. Like it's good people trying to do good things, sticking together, and they're just not treating each other like shit. Like how novel.
Yeah. I mean, when they are treating each other like shit, it's clearly bad. Like it's they want you to know that that's bad.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, it's definitely recommend watching the show. I will say though, with the caveat that probably the first 6 to 8 episodes are pretty much just random things happening before the story actually starts to get settled.
They're still fun and you'll still enjoy it, but you'll wonder, why isn't the thing that we know is all supposed to be happening happening, which is the Avatar getting where he's supposed to be going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about studio news. Now, we did a Levelhead postmortem on Friday. So we'll just talk a little bit about postmortems. What's going on with that? Why do you do them? What's the story with postmortems? Sam, you want to kick this off?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, it's almost like when you start a project, you know, you typically want to sit down for at least 30 seconds and say, why am I doing this?
At least
30 seconds. What's the goal? Who's involved, etc. And kind of plan out the path. Really having a really clear vision up front is very helpful, even in a jam context. You know, we've talked about this in game jams. We'll usually take just, you know, an hour or so, talk about stuff, and then get our basically 30-second plan put down on the whiteboard, and that guides literally 2 days worth of dev, right? So what happens then on the end of a project is that you kind of need to do the same thing but backwards, because what's really important about whenever you actually do manage to finish something is taking a beat and looking back at how that finishing actually occurred, any of the major problems you saw, and then also if you have a history of work at that point, a body of work, to ask the question on a really high level, are there any patterns in the execution or in the flaws of this work that I've also seen in my previous stuff, right? So is there any meta-level things that I clearly need to recognize and work on those too? And the whole point is that it's, you know, you could just keep on moving forward as fast as possible, you know, leave no time between projects, etc. But really, you want, it's a DevOps principle. You want to be able to take the lessons that are visible in your previous history of work, and essentially take the time to extract them, make changes based on them, such that you don't make the same damn mistakes the next time around. You'll make different.
But also take some time to dig for those that aren't visible.
Yes,
because I think most of the things that you get to learn from a project are the ones that that in terms of advancing the next one, you know, and doing it better are things that you can't actually see if all you do is think back to what happened. And you need some forms of kind of guided thoughts, basically to ask questions like, where is waste happening? The kinds of stuff that goes into like a DevOps-y kind of analysis. It's actually those pieces, those things that force you to think about the problems in a different way that allow you to reveal the hidden stuff and figure out what you're missing.
Yeah. So asking vague questions like, how did it go? Don't do that. you're not directing your brain in the effective enough way.
The question always is along which dimension, you know, did something happen?
Mm-hmm. And so what we did on Friday then was we just sat down and we had this, you know, big list of questions to burn through. And they're not complicated. It's stuff like, you know, where did we spend too much time in dev? What were some expensive moments or decisions that we made? What are repeat problems that we've seen now that Levelhead's done that we've also seen in our previous projects, et cetera. And so you just kind of...
Ooh, my favorite question, though, was what information did we choose to ignore that turned out to be important?
Mm-hmm. Or that we misinterpreted.
Because that's always the case that as we are like choosing what kind of a game to make or when to launch it or what features to put in or whatever, we're always making these decisions based on a variety of factors, one of which is looking out into the market and trying to figure out where we fit. Right? Like, mm-hmm. Where does this game belong? Are we doing something new? Are we doing something that people want? Like, are we making a game that has a place in the market and all those things? And we're making those decisions around a lot of external information. But just because we have the information doesn't mean that we used it, right?
Used it well in retrospect.
Yeah.
Given that we'll also know – so you always know – like, it's not fair to also look back and be like, I should have done this and like I'm an idiot for not, right? Although right. Like, sometimes that is true. But usually mm-hmm. It certainly isn't helpful. But it's usually the more the case that now that I've learned a whole bunch of other stuff and now that I've seen the outcome and I can put that original decision into a bigger context and interpret it better, then now I can see where if I had made a different decision there, the outcome might have been this other thing that I think is better, right? And then the question there is not like, oh no, now I have to just feel sad about how that wasn't the decision I made. But the question is, is there something, some way of looking at the world that you can pull out of that you get to move that, take that thing moving forward?
Right. Yeah. Figure out the why. Like, why did I ignore this information? And what was the consequence? And if that mattered, how do I, you know, try to avoid making that same
mistake? Is this specific to this one project? Or is it something a little bit more universal that I can take and move forward?
Yeah. So I personally love doing these things because it just makes you dig deep, you know, and just think what happened? Why did we do the things that we did? And then you get to just like bundle it into a nice package of rules and ideas going forward. And we actually, so as we've been working on Crashlands 2, which we're still in this kind of like pre-production planning phase for Crashlands 2. We're just asking a lot of questions about what is this game even going to be? And in some cases, the questions are like, is this even the right game to make? You know, mm-hmm. and going back through the we were able to go through our Crashlands postmortem, which is 4 years old at this point because we finished Crashlands over 4 years ago and we did a postmortem afterwards. And we got to go back and look at the decisions that we made, why we did the things that we did, how at that time, how we thought that worked and where we thought the game would be going, you know, from there. And it's nice to have this all recorded because, of course, we don't have to try to memory is unreliable and we don't have to try to remember all the things that happened and all the reasons we did those things. So it's been incredibly helpful. If you are in an industry where you develop, you know, projects like this back to back, Or if you just do this as or like for your own stuff, hobby, then it's still good. Like whenever you finish something, then go ahead and jam out a postmortem.
Oh yeah, right? And this review process is it's not something you can think about. Postmortems is like they're these mega reviews, right? Where it's you spent 2 years on something, now spend a day or two thinking about what just happened. But doing this review process on just about anything. Will improve.
You can do it week by week.
Yeah,
I mean,
but it doesn't maybe, even have to maybe be, you're on. It doesn't even have to be about the project. That's what I'm saying. Like, I used to do these every week just for my own stuff.
It's just like, how's my life going?
Yeah. How did this go this week? How was my relationship this week? What could I do? You know, what did I do wrong? Like, blah, blah, blah. It's like, there's a lot to getting out of that. And then when I do, if you're doing art practice or coding practice or stuff like that, this is exactly the sort of thing to do there too, which is you don't just draw a ton of pictures and expect to get better. That's just not how it works. You draw a picture and then literally do a review and say, where did I have trouble? What do I need to focus on? Blah, blah, blah. And like, it seems weird because you'll spend less time drawing, but you will get better so much faster than everybody else who's just scribbling, right?
Yeah, because you need to spend more time drawing the right things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with work and life too. So.
Yeah. So that's super fun. Definitely think about incorporating postmortems as a routine aspect of whatever it is that you do. Otherwise, studio news, the patch, the Levelhead patch. It's currently in beta on mobile now. So we are in Steam beta and mobile beta. We are reaching that point where we're just kind of like chipping away at a few small last minute bugs. But it's about ready to be submitted for console cert. And then it'll come out at some point. The cert process, you know, we've developed our own internal cert process to try to anticipate all the things, you know, that we might run into during the console cert.
Yeah, give you a check – or not exactly a checklist, but a document anyway, yeah, describing all of the requirements that you have to pass so that you get to know ahead of time. But some of them are a little bit up to interpretation when it comes to the specifics of your game.
There's varying levels of enforcement, you know, as time passes. But we feel like we've gotten pretty good at understanding these requirements and getting through. So we don't anticipate any particularly major snags. But at the same time, just because of a lot of the things that are going on, especially with the pandemic, these cert timelines have shifted a lot, and they've become more unpredictable. Yeah. So
it'll still be a while before the patch actually comes out. It's long and
short. We can't yet say when the patch will come, because it's not really up to us at this point. But we are it's moving along, and it's in a really good spot. And actually, ED Feed made a great a YouTube video where he just kind of like ran through, it took him a half hour, but he ran through all of the things, all of the new things in the patch. And he did it on Twitch, so you can see people kind of chatting in there. And definitely go to the Levelhead subreddit, and you'll be able to find that video cool there. So then last little bit of news. So this past week, we've just been working on we're calling it the B-Scotch ID burn down. So B-Scotch ID is a very old piece of web crap technology, yeah, and all web technology
/ crap.
All of our old games rely on it. They're built on it. This is really bad, and it keeps us from being able to maintain those games or patch them. Or even like when we launched Levelhead, you know, we had the conversation of how cool it would be to get a quest in Crashlands where you can like get a GR18 pet, because Crashlands has pets, right? Like, what if you could get a perk in Levelhead that would give you a GR18 pet in Crashlands? It would be crazy, right? Well, guess what? We can't. We can't do that because B-Scotch ID. Because Levelhead uses Rumpus and Crashlands uses B-Scotch ID, and B-Scotch ID is so fragile, we cannot change anything in there. So we've been looking at all this, and we know that we have to change it. And so we've landed on this kind of fun solution. So without going into the like technical web shit, the basics of it is B-Scotch ID right now is doing its own thing, and Rumpus is doing its own thing. We want to get rid of B-Scotch ID and only have Rumpus. So we are essentially turning B-Scotch ID into a tube that just connects all of the old games to Rumpus. So you'll be just playing your Quadrupus Rampage or whatever, and you won't even know it. But it's already the case that all of your B-Scotch ID perks in Quadrupus Rampage, they're in Rumpus now.
Yep.
You didn't even know. You didn't even know that happened.
Which is Levelhead could go fetch those. Like, we don't have a reason to yet, or maybe ever, but it could, which is the important thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's like phase one is basically turning all of these parts of B-Scotch ID into tubes.
The entubing.
And then part two is in the games themselves, ripping B-Scotch ID out and putting Rumpus in.
Yeah. The goal being to make it as seamless as possible. And the one thing that we did learn after taking through Beastcatch ID's code was that we can't make it completely seamless because the login system is so bad and dumb.
Yep.
That we basically can't trust it. So I'm not going to give any details, obviously, because one, that would bore most people, but also because, you know, security, right?
But it will be the case that you'll have to log back
in. You will have to log back in once we replace Beastcatch ID with Rumpus because we cannot sufficiently trust a Beastcatch ID login to allow it to manage your data on.
But here's the crazy part. Here's the crazy part. And I'm so pumped about it is that we've added Beastcatch ID as a way to log into Rumpus.
Yeah.
So you can still just use your Beastcatch ID credentials from before. So when we put Rumpus into, say, Quartopus Rampage, you'll just hit the login button, just put in your same Beastcatch ID username and password, and now you're logged into Rumpus.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we're doing all this fun shit. It's been really interesting.
Yeah. Are we also going to let you, like in Quartopus Rampage or in Crashlands, are we also going to let you log in using the platform native methods?
We can. We haven't really settled on that, but because we've already got those hooked up to Rumpus now, it should not be very hard for us to add like Google Play Game Services login or Apple sign in or whatever.
It's probably going to be uncommenting some things. So.
Yep. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that to step it all the way back, the reason this is super important, because I think that what's been really fun about it for Adam and Seth and Sure is sort of burning down this thing that has been just a constant low-key source of issue.
Basically, it's a source of work and anxiety.
Just for years. Yep. And so as far as, you know, again, we talk about when you wrap up a project and you start moving either even like, you know, with Levelhead's update. This is something we started working on while we were working on Levelhead's update. In other words, you know, we're talking about Levelhead, we're talking about the ability to keep on adding stuff to it in the future. Even if that's something we do a couple more times while we're working on the next project like Crashlands 2, we want to be able to, before we like really embark and get away from all this code, is to like just clean it up, clean everything up, burn stuff down that should have been burnt down years ago, like take the time so that when we return to either Levelhead or Crashlands or Quadrupus Rampage or whatever, that we can actually, you know, enjoy –
we can actually add stuff.
Doing some work. We can add some stuff. We can also not be just constantly worried that maybe something's going to explode. So it's a super exciting time. In a weird, it's a cleaning out your closet sort of a sense. It's very exciting to get it all done.
Yeah. Yeah. I am. It's just such a relief. It's the spring cleaning of game development. Yep. Right. Yeah. So that's all the stuff that we've got going on in the studio. A lot of interesting like lessons that we're pulling out and it's on the one hand, it can feel like we are, quote, doing nothing in the sense that the next project is not being actively developed right now. But that's okay. We got to take this time to make sure that we can actively develop the next project quickly and easily. So, all right. Well, that's I think that's all the studio news. So let's get on to questions. All right, these questions come from our listeners over at podcast.bscotch.net. Highest upvoted question comes from Chalosis. What game would you make if you had a $100 million budget?
I don't know.
The same game that if we didn't, in the sense that I think kind of the idea here that's sort of being conveyed is that you can now, there's no longer constraints, right? You can do whatever you want. You could go as big as you want, right?
But I had the same thought.
But there's a bunch of consequences to all of that, right? Which include you're gonna have to hire a bunch of people. I don't want to manage people. Managing people is unpleasant and sucks. We don't want to do it. So I still want to keep the smallest team possible. Okay, so there's that. We could, you know, go into 3D, right? Like make a new 3D thing. So that's gonna require rebuilding all of our tools and learning. Becoming experts now in a different engine and a different way of thinking about game design problems. But that one's a maybe, because that one we could still do without necessarily having to like scale up everything else, because with all that money, we could use it as a runway to train and to build tools.
Yep. Right? Mm-hmm.
So for me, when it comes to like, if we just had an unlimited budget, which is actually the dream, right? Just to have a game do so well that we now have it. To me, it's not actually about an unlimited budget for the next title. It's an unlimited runway. So that it doesn't matter what we make anymore. That's, to me, that's the dream. We get to make whatever we want. We don't worry about commercial viability. We don't worry about if we have to train for fucking 2 years to do it. We don't have to worry if we say, actually, we do want to hire somebody to do this one specific thing because we don't want to deal with that or whatever, right? We can do that. We can do anything. So that, yeah, but I don't want, what I don't want to have happen is that we scale up for the sake of scaling up, or that we build an MMO that we now have to like manage and maintain and now hire.
And have a customer service team.
Customer service, whatever to deal with. Yeah. Because sure, you can afford it now from a financial perspective, right? But that's actually the easy part is just having less money, right? As in like spending money on something, right? So if you have more money, like, ooh, now I can spend more money. Like that was the easy part. You just did the easy part. The rest of it is hard consequences, which is
hard. The hard part is time.
Yeah, like, the hard part is time.
Time is the limiting factor. So if we had a $100 million budget, I'd say we would just – personally, I would want to just do the thing we were already doing, but we can just take longer to do it bigger.
Yeah.
You know?
And I would honestly probably work less. I'd probably work 4-day weeks instead of 5-day weeks. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just pace yourself more.
I just pace myself more. I would worry about everything. Well, I wouldn't worry about anything, actually, is the reality of it, right? I would still do the work, and I would still make the game because like that's what we want to do.
What this reminds me of is I've seen a lot of memes and jokes about this, you know, the current state of the world. One of them that keeps recurring is this idea that you know you're an introvert when there's a global pandemic and your lifestyle doesn't noticeably change.
Right.
Yeah, this is kind of similar. I don't know what it means, but just that like that if we suddenly had a $100 million budget, then we've all pretty much agreed that we would just kind of keep doing the thing that we were already doing. I think that's good.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Well, if that had to go into like one game, then I would just say, depending on where that money came from, I would say we need to give most of this back, right? Because we're not.
Yeah, I don't know how the fuck you would spend $100 million. Yeah,
or you do something else where you just say, okay,
we spend on advertising.
We'll hire Sony Santa Monica Studio, who made God of War, and we'll be like, just do that for Crashlands. We'll chat about it. You know, like, right. We'll just chat about it.
We would need a bigger budget.
Yeah, that's not quite enough.
That's the thing. Yeah, you need a bigger budget. Yeah, yeah. I think that's actually the funny point. Is like, and I don't know if it's the combination of our expertise at this point, plus our realistic understanding of how things operate as you scale up, means that for the most part, I think we don't necessarily want a $100 million budget for a game. Because what that means –
if we scaled up, we would not be making the game.
No. Yeah.
No. And we would be paying the team to make it.
Is that if you have a $100 million budget, you have to keep in mind what that means, which is that your goal is to make more than $100 million on that project.
Yeah, because you got to break
even on that. Which – spoiler alert, we have not yet managed to do. So we don't know how to make more than $100 million.
Well, the fact is we don't know how to convert $1 in into $1 out. That's not a thing we can do on purpose, right? Yep. So yeah, actually, if anything, if we had to actually – so yeah, if we think about this from two ways. One is like we just have that money now, in which case like we'll just spend it. I don't even give a shit because that's enough money to pay ourselves for the rest of time and who cares. But if we had to dump that into one project and then turn a profit on it, because let's say like a publisher gave us that much money, which would be insane, right? Then I would say no. I would say no to that, and I would just back away slowly. That's too much.
There's no reason for us to have that much money.
No,
there's no good reason for that. or here's another. Hear me out, guys. $100 million budget. Okay, we pivot. We no longer make games. We are now just pure podcasting empire. Mm. Because here's the thing, Joe Rogan, he signed a $100 million exclusive contract with Spotify. So we know that at least in one case, somebody has demonstrated that you can turn a podcast into $100 million. We know this now, right?
Yep.
So, given that that's the case,
we need to add a lot more pseudoscience to our podcast, I think, before we can
go with
Joe Rogan.
I'm going to need to do a lot of peyote in the mountains also, or something like that, you know?
We need to say dude and bro a lot more, and then I think we can get ourselves there.
As far as I understand, the things that make a podcast like really go is guests, conspiracy theories, and weed.
Yep. Those are yeah, we don't really do that. We don't do any of those three things.
It is a market fit problem. But, you know, we can adapt.
Yeah, if we're going to pivot, we might as well just go right into blockchain and AI. You know, that's the future.
That's where everybody's really at, baby.
That's where the money's at. All right, next question comes from Puff Slapper Hoplongi, who says...
These automatic rumpus names are sometimes just off the chain.
Yeah, I would say most of the people who are new to the podcast page, who came after the introduction of random rumpus names, have just stuck with the random rumpus names they've gotten, and I'm all about it.
Which is so funny because it's one of those things too. Like, because if you get a username on something, one of the first things you always do is go change it to the one that you want, right? Yes. Even if you didn't even know that there's an option, you assume it's an option to go figure it out. It's actually easy to find and for rumpus, right? So that means that these people got that name and they
were like, this is who I am.
Yeah, this is perfect. There's no reason for me to change this.
Yep. So Puff Slapper says, recently one of you, I assume Sam, mentioned that you had really gotten into animation during Levelhead. Yeah, it's probably Sam.
That was the accurate.
I was wondering what kind of process you use for animation and if you have any tips for breaking into animation.
I got no tips for breaking into it because I just started doing it more literally in the midst of a project for a studio that I run. So that's nobody hired me to do this, I guess, is an important note. But I think as far as the high interest goes for me, it came from, or I guess just, you know, the extent of it is still a very basic sort of bare bones study at this point. Like because of the limited frames that we tend to the frame restrictions we put on our games. So I haven't gotten to do a lot of in-betweens and breakdowns and all sorts of other fancy stuff. It's mainly just really trying to make clear lines of action and get really good keyframes and stuff like that. So when it comes to tips for it, I think one is to make sure you...
The question is, how do you start studying it is probably the real question here, right? It's like...
Yeah. So, there's a really good... I looked at pixel art tutorials for animation. And in fact, for vector art and just for video game art in general, if you're doing 2D stuff, people, they always frame it as like, oh, it's a pixel art tutorial for shading. But the reality is like, if you just take the lessons and apply it to whatever 2D, you might be painting something. It doesn't matter. The lessons are always good. If they're really, really high quality tutorial on pixel art. And that's a way to actually find out, because pixel art is one of the few artistic mediums that is, of course, embracing the exact constraints that you typically have in a video game context. And so I found that super useful. And I looked at, in particular, there's this guy named from Synced11 was his Patreon, I think. I think it's Pedro. He did some work on Celeste and a bunch of other stuff. He's done a bunch of really incredible pixel art. And there's these GIF breakdowns of like how to animate an explosion. And it's just frame by frame. And it's also, it's a GIF. So it's actually going while you're looking at it, which is kind of amazing. So I literally, as I was, you know, in Levelhead, as we were working on various things, I'd be like, oh, how should I, like, instead of just saying, I'm going to animate lightning now and just make it some dumb shapes. Yeah, I would, you know, just take literally an hour, go find a tutorial someone made or two, and then do the tutorials and then, you know, put my own spin on it. And so that's really, it's been in sort of like a bit by bit sort of a way as we've been going along. And so that's why the animations for Levelhead's creatures and stuff have gotten more complicated as the project went on. They now do even the jibber jabbers, the creatures that are coming in on the new patch have a much more aggressive and different animation style than the previous characters do. They really distort, like their jaw just kind of like fully opens and stuff. So as far as the tooling, this is actually an issue, which is that I'm using Inkscape, which, shocker, is not for animation.
An animation tool.
So how do I animate? Basically, I draw the first thing, whatever the creature actually is, after doing the sketches, do the drawing there, and then just duplicate it and then put it into position however it needs to be for the animation, or draw the new frame, new keyframes. And then I have to fucking export this and upload it onto gifmaker.net. Okay. And then play it back so I can see. Yeah. So Adam said they're grimacing because this is one part of our tools pipeline that there are no tools that we currently have in the pipeline.
And it's basically we built our art tooling pipeline back in the Crashlands days. Like, it actually has not been updated for Levelhead.
Nope.
And even the beginning of Levelhead, there still wasn't a decision that we're going to – because during the Crashlands time, Seth did all the animation in code.
Yeah. Correct.
And so Sam would make an art asset and then break it into pieces and export it as individual pieces. Then Seth would go animate it somehow. And that was
– Somehow, indeed.
And I think that was kind of the plan with Levelhead at the start, at least, was like basically keep on doing what we're doing, right? And then Sam had been getting into animation and like trying more and more stuff. And then eventually
the truth is, like, I mean, Levelhead's when I got into art, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, actually got into it. And so it's absolutely, yeah, you're absolutely right, Adam. Like, we didn't plan to do a lot of animation. And then it turned out that I had built, I think Jerry Teen has like 58 or more frames baseline, and then all the different power up frames.
Since I've been working on the Crashlands project, so Crashlands has texture pages at 2048 by 2048, right? And it has like 28 texture pages. Levelhead's texture pages are each four times the size because they're 4096 by 4096. Mm-hmm. And it has like 65 texture pages.
Yeah.
So Levelhead has a fuckload more art than Crashlands.
Oh, yeah. 100%. Like, I made – there's so much more art in Levelhead than in Crashlands. It's kind of ridiculous. And a lot of it is in animation, right? Because frame-by-frame stuff is just
– yeah, totally.
Expensive. I've really enjoyed it. I think as far as cracking into the animation industry, like I said, I don't think I can actually honestly give any good advice as far as the cracking in part. But as far as just the practice goes, it's the same thing, which is don't think about it as like a huge, gigantic – task to go undertake.
Learn all of animation.
Yeah,
animation. You can't just learn animation.
Yeah, it's like if you have a project and you're like, oh, I'm going to put a bird in here, just ask the question, how could I animate this bird? And if you want to do it in sort of 2D frame by frame style, that's one thing. If you want to do it in more of the bone animation style, that's another. If you're doing 3D, it's another. And just say, okay, like find a tutorial. Someone's like, here's how you animate a bird flying. And then just do it. And you just sort of stack these things bit by bit as opposed to trying to tackle it like just wholesale, because I think it's just much easier to see the progress as you go and roll
through. Is there some foundational knowledge that's like gestures or something that's really useful?
So gesture drawing is incredibly good. And there's
smears.
There's videos. Yeah, there's videos on YouTube for this. Gesture drawing, incredibly important and fundamental for anything involving motion, if you're trying to convey motion. Okay, so there's that. There's the 12 fundamentals of animation. There's a YouTube series on these that's fantastic, and these are basically the 12. It's just like fundamentals for drawing or anything else, where it's the 12 things that if you do these things, your stuff looks good, and that's about it. And then there's smears, which come in a couple different flavors, and again, just look up YouTube videos on animation smears, which are just like my favorite thing ever. It's basically the abstraction of motion blur, because you don't have motion blur when you're doing frame-to-frame animation. So you simulate it by drawing it in. Sometimes, that means a character for a single frame has eight eyes and their arm is stretched across the entire screen and they look like a demon for a sec. But when you watch
it, Sam's frames are pretty wild. If you catch them, if you take a screenshot or something like and catch the right moment in an animation, you'll be like, what the fuck am I looking
at? Oh, so good. So I think that's why I liked it so much, where it's like the way you break down the between keyframes, that the way you put a smear in there or a pose in there, whatever else, ends up completely changing the feel of the animation. And it's just so fun. So, yeah, I've had a really good time exploring it. But those things are kind of the big ones. And again, just check it out on YouTube and then just slowly, bit by bit, kind of integrate it into your whatever you're working on. It's a ton of fun.
Yeah. Also, you saying, this idea about somebody saying, like, I want to learn animation. But actually that animation is – it's a collection of hundreds and hundreds of small skills. Skills and ideas. It kind of reminds me of when people say, I'm not good at computers.
Yeah. Which part? The typing? Which is
like, what turning part it on? About computers? Right. Anyways. All right. Next question comes from Beaky Bapa Boop, who says, so it looks like there won't be a Shenana Jam or a Shenanicon this year. Mm-hmm. So what will fill the void of events starting with Shenani?
Mm-hmm. Well, I know the Game Maker's Toolkit is what we've been pushing people toward for the Shenani Jam fix, because it ends up being on the same weekend anyways. And
that's a lot bigger than ours.
It's now huge. It's like a couple thousand people in there this year.
It's and like so, 10 times bigger or 20 times
bigger.
Yeah,
I think it's at least 4,000 people or something. So I definitely go do that. I mean, Mark Brown's channel, by the way, if you like game design, the Game Maker's Toolkit channel is fantastic. He does these really kind of long form breakdowns on just various design things. I mean, they're super good. I literally use them for reference. I'm like, oh, what do people think about stealth games? Just Google that thing and then find his stuff. And I'm like, okay, I now know what
they he's got some good ideas.
He's got some great stuff.
But I think this kind of – we had some conversations about this earlier this year about the Shenanah Jam, the Shenanah Con, their role, like how they mm-hmm. how they fit into our broader goals as a studio. And the thing we kept kind of coming back to is like it's too early. It's actually – you know, we had some ideas and we ran the Shenanah Con a few times and we'd get, you know, 35, 40 people to come to that thing, which is, and it was fantastic. It was great to get to meet all those people, and spend time. But at the same time, if we're going to put on like a convention to try to like bring together people from across the country who are fans of the games and stuff like that, you know, we probably want to go bigger. Yeah. Than that.
When you realize that, like, okay, your studio can really only produce like 4 hours worth of convention content.
Yeah. Well, this is the problem, because when we're looking at something like BlizzCon, you know, Blizzard is a huge company and they have hundreds of people,
hundreds of employees.
And so they got tons of games, tons of employees, and they'll have an entire weekend. They got panels, they got events, they got cosplay competitions. So, like, mm-hmm. it is a convention that is
they also a huge have celebration. A 35-year history of game content.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and that's really the key, right? Because like BlizzCon didn't start until Blizzard had been around for like 17 years or some shit. I think the first one was in like 2005. And so and think about it in those terms, you know, our studio is young. Our IP is not as well known. It's not well established. And we're still kind of like getting ourselves propped up in the industry. And the fact is, since we're still small, it's still us primarily making the games. And, you know, if we take our time to throw these conventions or host these jams and stuff, it's just too early, because that's time that we need to be spending building our IP more and like putting more mm-hmm. into developing our games. So we've kind of decided to ease back on pursuing these like these big events for now, until we reach a point where we feel a lot more comfortable with the scope and reach of our portfolio and just how big our audience is and yeah. that kind of stuff.
And speaking to that, I mean, so, I think over the last couple of years, there's also been a big shift in terms of our approach to jams generally, which is that it used to be the case that like I could never wait to go like work on a just random ass game for, you know, 40 hours over a weekend and then throw it in the trash can afterward. We've done that a bunch now. And I think it sort of hit its peak last year with Fields of Goop, because we built a fucking MMO in 2 days. And so it worked. And like, and I honestly, that like that memory of I think we had like 70 people who popped into that thing during the, like at the yeah. kicked in the Shenanigan gym, and everyone's just like hanging out, eating each other, because you could do that in that game. Just sitting down and chatting, because we had a chat client in there, and like, it was so wonderful and magical. And I was like, I am good. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is it. And I think what I want when I get a 2 day jam or something, I still like to jam, but it literally now is always about some specific hard thing with whatever the current project is. It's like, oh, I mean, we did this actually, I think, with Levelhead once or twice. In fact, we did with the new player experience thing. We were like, okay, let's take like 2 days and just make some tutorial stuff, make some of these, all these changes that we just found. And so
that's true. Yeah. We did it, during the Global Game Jam.
That's what it was. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
Friday,
we didn't make a game. Instead, we just worked our asses off on establishing a new player experience for Levelhead.
Yep.
And that was the whole weekend.
And it was great. It was so fun. And I think part of it was like, as the reality of like, you know, running and owning a business comes and stuff like that, it's like, you get to this point where you say, you know, well, we know what the issues are. Or so we know what some of the things are that we haven't had the time to examine. And jam is really just about that sort of freewheeling, like, let's go explore, let's go do something wild and then have something done. And I think that those are exactly the targets that then are really fun to do that on, where you say, okay, we haven't done the new player experience stuff with Levelhead. On Friday afternoon, after work's done, until Sunday night, the goal is to identify everything, make a plan, and then execute as much as humanly possible by Sunday night, right? And
yeah,
they're really fun. They're so fun to do. And so, yeah, I don't know. I feel like our approach has just kind of changed a little bit.
I think it just became more fun to do it on an existing project than to make.
Yeah, that's true.
One, right.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely true.
Yeah. And I think that Because, man, we have to have done at least like 60 jams.
We've done our fair share, yeah.
As a team. And that's disregarding the ones that I've done, you know, solo and or even just like weekend prototyping and stuff like that. I mean, they are so unbelievably useful for establishing a wide and deep library of knowledge about how to build things, mm-hmm. right? Like just getting something up and running and figuring out what are the pieces, what do you have to consider, how do you make these systems talk to each other? Because I, you know, it's something that I tell people a lot who ask me how to get started in like making your own games. And I always tell the story of Sky Brawler, which was the first game that I worked on. And I worked on that first game for a year. And I genuinely feel like I didn't really start to learn about what it meant to make games until I put that project aside and started making a game in a week and a game in a weekend mm-hmm. and another game in 3 days, you know, because all of a sudden I was making a huge variety of kinds of games with all different systems, and I got to learn about everything, right? And then that diversity of knowledge is what I think really allowed me to accelerate super fast.
Yeah, and this is the same rule that you see for if you're getting started in art or anything else. Is actually, weirdly enough, even though there's a strange thing about finishing pieces, they basically, the general rule of thumb is actually you should only be finishing maximum like one out of every 10 things that you start, maximum, because the truth is like most of the knowledge, like unless you're studying finishing, in which case don't do the earlier part. Grab someone's line work from online, for example. If you're trying to work on coloring and shading, don't fucking draw the thing. Just work on the coloring and shading by grabbing someone else's line work, right? Like there's ways to just focus exactly on the thing that you need to be working on quickly, as opposed to having to go through the whole process end to end. And I think that's definitely something that we didn't understand early on in game dev, but also I didn't understand in art, honestly, until like we said with Levelhead last year. And like, Adam, I don't know if this is related to your science stuff at all as far as getting a PhD is concerned, but like multiple smaller, much more rapid, essentially experiments seem to be a much better way to grow.
Yeah. Well, I mean, everything else is a lot riskier, right? Because learning is being able to do an entire process and get rapid feedback. Learning is just rapid feedback. That's the process, right? And the slower the feedback is, the less you learn, sort of by definition. And so if the way that you are trying to learn is by making a, you know, 5-year scale project, then every component of that project you're now learning about over those 5 years for one specific case, right? Versus if you were to instead take a year of those 5 years, make a different thing every week and make 50 different things, right? The amount of knowledge you now have is vast, so that when you go off on what was now going to be an original 5-year journey and you've got 4 years left, you can do it in 6 months or whatever, right? Because mm-hmm. we take Skyblock, as Seth mentioned, working a year on, right? If you were to make that same thing now, that is a jam game, right?
Yeah.
It's a jam game.
Well, I mean, the purpose of the game was to have a huge amount of content. Like, that was the idea behind it.
But you didn't have it after a year.
I had maybe 2% of it done after a year.
So. Yeah, but in terms of like what you ended up with after that year, though, like that quantity. Mm. So not the original design, but like the thing you ended up with after a year of work is something that you could now produce today in presumably a couple of weeks.
Yeah,
the point being here that it's that the stuff is very, very costly when you don't know much about it or when you only have one approach to a thing. And so it's that diversifying of experience that is the thing that allows you to go fast later. And it's actually so valuable that that spending your time up front diversifying your experience is going to be a beneficial long-term investment that makes your future projects go so much faster that you didn't even lose time. It's just DevOps all over again, right?
Yep.
You got to invest your time in the right spots up front. And I think you do need to be careful with the idea of like – of only practicing starting things, or only practicing certain portions of things, and so on, because like the other trap that we see people fall into is basically never finishing things, and so they don't know how to do that part. Mm-hmm. And finishing something, so starting a thing is that's the first thing that's the hardest, right? Because you don't even know how to start yet, right? So starting a thing is the hardest. Then eventually you can start stuff. You can do that now. You started a whole bunch of things, right? And then now finishing stuff is the hardest because you've already know how to start stuff, and people kind of forget that that finishing a thing isn't just continuing to do the thing until you decided you're done. That's not how that works, right? It's identifying – it's actually mostly about identifying what's important and identifying holes that are missing and whether they might – it's all actually about triage. Yeah. It's about cost-benefit analysis and in understanding what a thing is for and then determining market fit and like all this kind of stuff that is not really about the initial part, which is, ooh, I have this idea for a cool thing, right? Finishing it is all now, what's the point of this? What am I doing with this and how do I get to that end state? As rapidly as possible, following the good enough principle, so that I don't spend 5 years perfecting animations that have twice as many frames as they need because nobody's going to give a shit when they see it, right? And that sort of thing. So these are all different, and I think, and then when it comes to any discipline, being able to rapidly iterate on complete projects that are somehow representative of larger scale complete projects because they let you do every single piece of it, but just with a much tighter feedback loop. I think that is how you learn how to become able to actually produce and actually implement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, this is, and think about it as a cost benefit thing. If you've never done something and you have no information of what it will take to do that thing, to make that game or whatever, you don't know the costs, right?
Yeah.
And if you never finish something, you also don't know the benefits because right. If you spend like a year or two working on one game that you never finish, then your diversity of knowledge about various game systems and how to execute various things will be very limited. And you also won't know what it takes to finish something, and you won't know the possible benefits of finishing the thing either. Yep. So there was this thing called I don't know if it's still running, but it was a website called One Game a Month.
Yeah, I think it's One Game.
Yeah, which was – yeah, it was like a community of people who just said, I want to learn how to make games and I'm going to start and finish and publish a game every month for some amount of time, maybe for a year or something like that. And you can see like people who do this thing, their game that they make in month 12 is vastly better than the game they make in month one.
So now imagine they just started making that game in month one and just kept on working on that for 12 months instead. Right. Well, now you just have a shitty thing that took you 12 months instead of
a shitty cool giant thing.
A shitty giant spaghetti nightmare.
Yeah. So that's definitely the approach to take. Anyways, I think that's all the time we have for this week. Yeah.
Cool.
Yep. Definitely. So anyways, we'd like to thank our producers, Fat Bard and Jen Koster, for putting the podcast together. And thanks to our community moderators to keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the Butterscotch community, you can just go to podcast.bscotch.net, where we have links to the community Discord, a way for you to donate, and a link to the podcast archives. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week.
Goodbye.